Doctors, U.S. troops, and emergency aid workers continue to arrive in Haiti from all over the world. The medical needs are huge. Injuries from collapsed buildings, dehydration, and the looming threat of widespread disease. In a moment, we'll hear about search and rescue efforts in Haiti. But if you are in the medical profession and have served in disasters, or you have questions about how to help, our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. With us is U.S. Air Force Chief Master Sergeant Antonio Travis. He's a part of the Special Operations Search and Rescue Team in Haiti, and he joins us from Port-au-Prince. Welcome to the program. Chief Master Sergeant Antonio Travis, are you with us on the line from Port-au-Prince?
Loud and clear. How are you all doing?
I'm doing fine. Have you been able to rescue people still trapped in the rubble?
I've got a four-man search rescue team that is attached to the Fairfax County Search and Rescue. Those guys are doing a phenomenal job, man. They've since my guys have been attached to them, they've pulled 13 personnel out successfully. They had one rescue event that spent 24 to 28 hours. They were able to get the patient lady out. We got her into surgery, and medevac her to the Dominican Republic, and all reports are that she's recovering well and doing well.
And so you've been able to pull 13 survivors out?
That's just since my fire rescue unit has been attached with the Fairfax County boys. I don't know how many they were able to pull out beforehand, and that's only one element. The Fairfax County guys out of Virginia are phenomenal at this. They've got to be the world's greatest. If anybody's out there broadcasting any better, they would have to come and work alongside them. So these guys integrated my pararescuemen. They're doing confined-based collapse structure rescue, pulling people out, taking 18, 20 hours to dig through rubble, using lift kits to raise floors to get underneath, crawling through rubble, crawling through holes to pull these individuals out. They're doing a phenomenal job as a civilian-military effort combined together.
And how exactly does that work? Do they have earth-moving equipment? Are they digging with their hands?
They don't have any earth-moving equipment that I've seen. I'm running the airfield operations with the air traffic controllers. Their rescuemen are equipped with lift kits, four or five different types of saws. The Fairfax County guys are fully equipped with saws, jackhammers, lift kits. They've cut down skid co litter so they're able to get into the holes to pull patients out where normally they wouldn't be able to get them out. They have just about anything they need to cut through the rubble, lift small pieces of rubble so they can get underneath, crawl underneath, try to pull somebody out. And they're doing a phenomenal job to get through there. We had first aid, my fire rescuemen were attached with them. They worked 30 hours straight and were able to successfully pull three people out.
And when the survivors are pulled out, are they able to get the medical attention they need?
That is first spot on. The first thing to do when they get out is they have a medical team there. I also have an individual duty medical technician and another Air Force medic who's there on site assisting with the medical treatment and triage. And the pararescuemen are the finest combat trauma medics in the world. And they assist with the civilian medics and the military medics that are there. They do the medical treatment triage and then push them out to the nearest medical facility. The best one so far was a double amputee that one of our pararescuemen used the SH-60 off the USS Carl Vinson to hoist out of the rubble, and was giving her the oxygen bag and the IV all the way up the hoist. And that was a very fine combined effort between the Navy, the civilians, and the Air Force personnel on the ground.
And so from what I know, you're working with this Fairfax County, Virginia team, and you're seeing, you know, your small slice of it. But in general, does it seem like there is a widespread enough search and rescue effort, or is more help needed?
I'm sorry, ma'am. Could you please say that again?
Do you feel like the search and rescue effort has the resources it needs?
I believe with bodies they have, they're doing everything they can. I personally have not been out on site. As I said, I'm running all the air traffic control here for the Port-au-Prince airfield. I don't know what all assets they have out there. The team that's with the Fairfax County boys are staging out of the embassy, and there are several other the LA County Miami. There's several other rescue organizations that are there, but I honestly do not have the information on how many rescue organizations are there and working out to try to pull survivors out now.
Well, tell me about the Port-au-Prince Airport, because we've been hearing that it's a logistical bottleneck and there have been issues with supply planes getting in and out. How are those issues getting resolved?
That is a true statement. It is a logistical issue to get them in and out. We came in on the first night on Wednesday, 28 minutes later, assumed control of the airfield and started running aircraft. The first full day on Thursday was an extremely jam-packed, difficult day. At one time, I had 42 aircraft on the deck, 17 in holding, and I want to say 97 between Miami-Dade, two here in route, and the ramp is normally designed for 12 to 13 aircraft. The issues are that the first day was getting the aircraft downloaded in a timely manner so we could get them off the ground and bring another aircraft in. When we arrived, we were only able to procure one forklift, and Special Operations Wing was able to fly in additional equipment the next day. The Special Operations Wing out of Pearlville, Florida, brought in some additional lift capability to download aircraft, and then we were able to work with the airfield management here. The personnel were able to call some of their individuals to help get some of the other equipment going. The first day, we had a difficult time getting everything unloaded because of lack of equipment and personnel. But with the personnel bringing in additional equipment and the station government willing to work with us to help us find and call in people that work equipment here on the airfield to bring it in, we were able to speed that up on the second and third day. And the first day we had average holding time for aircraft to come in 2 to 4 hours. We reduced that the second day to 45 minutes to 2 hours. And right now we're sitting between 15 minutes and an hour average holding time for getting aircraft on the ground.
Tony Travis, I want to let you get back to work there, because I know you have an incredible amount to do. Thank you so much for joining us.
I appreciate it, ma'am. You have a great day.
That's U.S. Air Force Chief Master Sergeant Antonio Travis. He joined us from Port-au-Prince, Haiti. And I know that line was a little hard to understand. He was talking about the airport delays at the Port-au-Prince Airport, which we have been hearing about. He said his first day there delays, the average holding time for incoming aircraft were 2 to 4 hours. On the second day, they got it down to 25 minutes to 2 hours, and it's now closer to 15 minutes to an hour holding time for incoming aircraft to the Port-au-Prince Airport. We are talking about the medical needs following Tuesday's earthquake in Haiti, how people can help. With us is Gerald Martone. He's a registered nurse and director of humanitarian affairs for the International Rescue Committee. He joins us from NPR's New York Bureau. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Rebecca.
So we're hearing about tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people needing help. How do you even begin to tackle something on that scale with limited resources?
Well, one of the things that's done in a large-scale emergency like this is that organizations are closely coordinated, often under the auspices of the United Nations. They'll set up coordination centers in what we call in the field cluster groups, where we work on the various sectors: water, food, sanitation, shelter, public health. And we organize around that. So we look for areas that are not being served, map the areas that are affected, and what areas the most of the needs are.
And how do you decide who gets treatment first?
Well, in the case of treatment and in individual health treatment, that's part of the practice of emergency medical care, is the triage, the prioritization of who is most injured and who needs care most acutely. So that's a decision done in every facility. You always look at the amount of people that are waiting to be served, select the ones that are bleeding or at most risk and need emergency treatment, and they get treated first.
What kind of injuries are medical professionals treating in Haiti?
At this moment, you're still seeing crush wounds. You're still seeing injuries related soft tissue trauma from falling structures. And now you will begin to see a lot of infected wounds that weren't cleaned or treated early enough.
Let's take a call from Tom in Sioux City, Iowa. Tom, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're on the air, Tom.
Oh, yeah. I'm the medical manager for the Urban Search and Rescue for Iowa Task Force 1, and I got to give a shout-out to the guys on the coast who have gone to Haiti. It sounds like they're doing a wonderful job down there. One of the things that we see most commonly, and we're in a profession of a lot of type A personalities, is they all want to rush in and help. I think it may be helpful to the listeners to understand that, as noble as that might be, if you're not going within an organized system like these search and rescue units are, that you can actually compound the problem. The difficulty is that when you go into an area as hard hit as Haiti, you carry with you an envelope of need, and that you need food, clothing, shelter, water, that the populace down there doesn't even have. So if you place a demand on their infrastructure, which is already non-existent, you become part of the problem rather than part of the solution.
Well, Tom, let me ask you this. We're hearing about all of these injuries, the time when the search and rescue teams are still pulling live injured people out of the wreckage is starting to grow short. So there is some urgency to needing medical attention down there. And as Gerald Martone says, some of these injuries are going to start to get infected. If you want to keep away, those type A volunteers who might get in the way and take scarce resources away from the survivors, how can they help?
The best way they can help, well, there's actually multiple levels. The best way to help for people who don't have staff qualifications to actually respond through an organized system is to backfill. If I'm able to deploy down there through an organized system, having a couple of other docs who will come in and help to fill my shifts in the trauma center. To have people at home so that if something happens to my house while I'm down there working, that somebody can help my wife get the basement emptied out of water. Not that Northwest Iowa, that's the problem this time of year.
For people, maybe shovel the driveway.
Shovel the driveway. That actually, yes, that is a tremendous need to support the folks who go down there. The rough ratio is 6-1. It takes about 6 support personnel back home for one person to deploy in the field. And we learned this from a military. This is why you don't send a Dear John letter to somebody under fire, because they'll put their head up and not pay attention to what's going on. The third way, though, and one of the most helpful ways, this sounds a little crass, but contributing money, giving the means to move a water purification unit, giving the means to purchase the oil to move a ship down there that has on it the supplies, that's something that anyone can do. And going through a good organization, I know to sum up on your website, getting through a good verified organization, giving to a charity that will get in there and do the work, that's a wonderful thing that people can do.
Tom.
Long-term base. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to thank you for your call and remind people that they can find resources on our website. You are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Gerald Martone, would you add anything to Tom in terms of things people can do if they're feeling an urgent need to help?
Yeah, I think Tom gave some very good advice that, first of all, it's very frustrating to be on the outside of a situation like this and not be part of it. Very hard to watch. And there's even a name for that syndrome called peripheral syndrome, where people who are not involved in rescue operations feel very much marginalized and on the outside, and it's a terrible feeling. And the urge, particularly people with a medical or emergency background, is to fly down there, is to go there immediately. As Tom mentioned, that's often not helpful to not have the support of an organization. You then become another person that needs to be taken care of.
So there's the immediate need now with people still being pulled out of the rubble and all of these crush injuries. You mentioned a potential for infection coming up. There is also often in the aftermath of disasters when sanitary conditions aren't great, widespread disease. How do you work to prevent that?
That's one of the biggest concerns is infectious disease. There's a lot of myths about that. The first thing we're worried about, of course, is drinkable water, is water that's not contaminated. One of the things an earthquake causes is ground rupture. Oftentimes, even here in the United States, water pipes are laid in the same ditch as sewage pipes. They're laid side by side. When there's a rupture in the ground, both pipes break, so there's contamination between sewage into drinking water. So securing water sources is vital, and contamination of those sources is a weapon of mass destruction. You get cholera or dysentery bacteria or even diarrhea viruses into a local water source, and it's a terrible infections can result. There's more than 50 diseases carried by water. So securing water sources is
vital. You mentioned there were some myths. Let's take a second to debunk some of those.
Well, the first myth that you often see in a disaster like this is dead bodies are infectious, that they're dangerous. And there's an unnecessary rush to get rid of dead bodies. And here in Port-au-Prince, we've already seen examples where mass graves were used. Bulldozers made very large holes in the ground and bodies were dumped in. This is done because of a concern that they're going to become infective. A human being is more infective when they're alive than when they're dead. When there's remains are not identified, family members are left with lingering questions of whether they're still alive, whether there's still hope, and it's really delays their grieving, as well as not having a place, a burial site to visit and pay respects and to continue having a connection. So it's tragic when that's done. It is not considered in professional aid work a best practice of handling the dead. So that's one myth that we're seeing.
We are almost out of time, but as someone who has had a lot of experience with emergency response, what would you say are likely the biggest challenges facing medical workers in Haiti?
The biggest thing we have to face now is realizing that this moment of search and rescue is just about over, and that we'll be facing a daunting, colossal task of recovery, of rehabilitation, and finally development of a country that's been very poor and neglected for many years.
Gerald Martone is a registered nurse and director of humanitarian affairs for the International Rescue Committee. He joined us from NPR's New York Bureau. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rebecca.
And also, again, thanks to U.S. Air Force Chief Master Sergeant Antonio Travis, who joined us earlier on the phone from Port-au-Prince, Haiti. And thanks again to all of our callers who have shared their stories of being in Haiti or reaching family there. Again, we wish all of you well and hope that you continue to get the news that you need from back in Haiti. Tomorrow, President Obama's first year in office through the lens of history. I'm Rebecca Roberts. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.